you're in the uncomfortable spot, and that's how you know you're going to grow. And I think it's okay to be uncomfortable. It's okay to make hard choices. It is okay to hurt when you make decisions that are right for the company, but hurt you emotionally, and it's sad. You can grieve parts of the business while growing and knowing that you're making the right decision.
I just kind of knew in my soul, I don't want to just survive this. I don't want that. That's not the company that I wanted to create. There's got to be some sort of path forward.
Welcome to Hitting the Ceiling, the show for entrepreneurs and leaders who refuse to let a ceiling become the end of their story. Michael Fleck bought Occasions Fine Jewelry from his father in 2014, and almost immediately the floor dropped out. His right-hand person died of cancer, oil prices fell, revenue started sliding. Denise Hutchinson had her own accounting company and no plans to return to the jewelry business she had grown up resenting. But she was pulled in to help her brother steady the ship, and in a hotel room, they cried, they worked, and they built a plan to shrink the company. And they never used it. Instead, they rebuilt. The business grew, the brand got stronger, but now Michael and Denise are facing a quieter ceiling, not failure, but a plateau. To break through it, they have to give up comfort, redefine their roles, build the structure, let go of people they care about, and make a second store bet before they know the next version of Occasions will work. Denise and Michael, welcome to Hitting the Ceiling.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you for having us.
So, Michael, you bought Occasions from your father in 2014, and almost immediately the floor dropped out. What happened?
So we live in Midland, Texas, which is the oil patch of the world, and oil dropped, which is always hard. But it's especially hard when you've just drained the accounts so that you can pay your father. And also, like I said, my right-hand man went home one day with a stomachache and just never came back. From there, I quickly realized that I was probably too reliant on just me and him making things work. And so stuff started to fall apart. I remember I had worked my 12th straight 12 or 14 hour day in a row. And I had just told everybody, the minute that I get this last thing done, I am leaving. Please don't come into my office. Please don't bring me anything. I'm going to go. And I think I slept for like 14 hours as soon as I got home at like 10 o'clock in the morning. So I remember thinking whenever I signed on the dotted line, I was like, you know, it feels like I'm paying a little bit more than I should. But as long as everything's going in this upward trajectory, this is going to be great and easy. And then immediately it just starts petering out. Denise was part-time back then, and she and I just sat in a hotel room at a conference. And instead of going into the conference, we didn't have money to buy anything anyways. We figured out how we could shrink the company to make it profitable again, who we would have to lay off and who we wouldn't. And then we, you know, cried about it, talked it over. And then I went down into the conference room and found a guy that I had been told, you need to talk to him. His name was Vince Rath. And he had been a good mentor of mine ever since that day. And, one of the first things he said is that, well, it sounds like you're deep into a victim cycle and blaming the world for your problems. And I was like, that's a good way to introduce yourself to me. You know,
hey, you're a victim.
Yeah. almost immediately, I was like, yeah, he's right. And we started the fairly grueling process of building ourselves back out of it. And then the store exploded and we were twice the size we were before I bought the company. And we just grew and grew and grew for years.
When you purchased the company, was your father involved with the business after the sale for any period of time? Or was it just hand you the keys and good luck, buddy?
Handed me the keys and went on a very long vacation. The end negotiations and the emotions of the purchase got to all of us. And there was an unspoken agreement that we all needed a break from each other in order to save the relationship, which I'm proud to say is incredibly healthy right now.
That's great. Because family businesses are really tough and you're obviously in one. And Denise, it sounded like you had your own accounting company at the time, working at the store that you grew up in part-time. You were observing the sale of the business. What are some of the lessons that you learned during watching Michael acquire the business and then being kind of brought back into the business?
I really enjoyed it. They brought me in, you know, part-time, and I did get a front row seat to all of it. And luckily, it was all very copacetic for the most part, but there was a lot of emotions. And, you know, I think the lessons I've learned from that are so many people's identities are tied around their job. Their day-to-day life is all tied around that business. And so when someone's buying a business, they're not just buying a building and people and products. They're buying somebody's ship that they built by hand. And especially when it's the person who started it. And I think the biggest lesson I learned in all of that is you have to respect those emotions. You have to understand them, but on both sides. The guy who built the ship has to allow the next generation to actually get it off the dock and actually go sail it. Go sail it and go sail it fast. And a lot of times that, you know, that initial person hears that little creak or that little whatever, and they want to batten the hatches and fix everything. And then that next generation comes in and they have plans. They've got navigation. They're going to sail it. So I think from the seat that I was in, that's kind of what I watched, was a lot of emotions and everyone having the same dream, the same goal, the same, you know, in desire, but a lot of emotions in the middle on how you should get there and the fear. There's a lot of fear too, that they're handing off the thing that they built and it might not go and run the way they thought it would.
And I think that oftentimes where you have that identity is wrapped up in the business and then you're selling the business and you don't have clarity on what you're going to do next. That's when we see, especially in family businesses, that the business is sold, but they're kind of drawn back to it anyway because they don't have that next thing. Did you have any instances where that occurred or pretty clean break and off to the races?
Compared to other companies, it was a fairly clean break. I would say personally for us, it didn't always feel that way. And it might be pretty minor stuff, but in the long run, they really did trust us. They really did trust Michael. They had a lot of faith in Michael. They knew Michael could do it. So there was never the doubt that Michael couldn't do it and they needed to step in. I think if anything, it was more of the parental, I want to try to protect you from something. And Michael's not the type that wants to be protected by something.
So Michael, tell me about, you're in that hotel room and you make a decision to make a plan to shrink the company as opposed to grow it or turn it around. What was the thought process, the two of you in that room, that you were purposely going to shrink instead of grow?
The first thought was we had tried everything to grow, or what we thought was everything at the time, and nothing moved the needle. Nothing was working. There was just no gas in the engine. So we sat there and tried all the best practices that we knew and all the best practices that we had looked up online or read a book about over the last 6 months to try and figure out how to get this thing to go. And it was just stalling out. So, you know, then it became, well, I don't want my family to be homeless. You know, I don't want my wife and I to lose our house. And so what do I do to just survive it? But, as soon as we made the plan, I just kind of knew in my soul, I don't want to just survive this. I don't want that. That's not the company that I wanted to create. And that there's got to be some sort of path forward. You build up in your industry this facade of who you are, and I start breaking down and just asking for help and talking to different people. And that's when I found out Vince Rath, a good friend of mine named Abe Sherman, he said, you need to go talk with Vince. Vince, if anybody has an answer, Vince has an answer. And so I went and chatted with Vince, and every consultant I've ever talked to, you know, pat you on the back and says how great you are. And he just eviscerated me within meeting him in 5 minutes. His last name is Rath, and I've made jokes with him several times that he lives up to his last name. And then from there, you know, really saying, where are my faults in all of this? Started opening up some new avenues, getting rid of some of the pride of it all. And we put together a big sale to just raise enough cash to start rebuilding. And I got every employee together, and I just laid it out there on that there are two options moving forward, and we're choosing this one, but you might not get to come along if you don't follow these guidelines. That was hard, because when you grow up in a family business, one, many people in that business had worked there longer than me, and two, I was taught from a very young age to really respect your employees, and that meant to me treating them like family and hugging them and getting through anything with them. And we had super long tenure, and that was one of the major problems that we had, was there was no accountability, because there was no chance of you losing your job. There was no warning system. There was no accountability, and there was just kumbaya and camaraderie and love. And those are great things, but they're not enough. Once that crack happened, and you could kind of see through, a path started to emerge little by little where, okay, we didn't try everything. We tried all the stuff that we knew and that my parents had taught me, but not everything. And that's when we started really reworking the company and getting the company to work for me. And it just started taking off quickly.
Denise, at that time, you ran an accounting firm and you resented the business maybe a little bit. What did Michael say to you to convince you to come and partner and grow the business?
It didn't take much convincing. Once I got in there, my brother and I have always been best friends. And so once I got in there and I went to these conferences, and it was people I've grown up with, it felt like family. And the jewelry industry is a small industry. I was really happy to do it. I think it was the right time. My brother has an economics degree. I have an accounting degree. So we can speak the same language, but he's very much a big picture person. I'm very much a, you give me the goal and I'll get us to the finish line person. So we instantly were, you know, kind of the power team in that respect. So it didn't take much effort to talk me into coming back. It really felt natural. And I fell back in love with this industry really quick, really quick. I got rid of my accounting firm pretty early on and became a consultant in the industry as well as working with Michael.
you take over the business, you go back in and you're going to grow this organization, you get the right people in the right seats. What has been hardest about enforcing culture when all the people involved are just so personally important to you?
The easiest is letting people you love go. You know, you have this mental image that they're gonna, you know, be homeless and they're gonna not have a life after you, because the only life you've ever seen them in is the life that they had with you as their leader and as their boss. It turns out there's a lot of other companies out there that want these experienced and good individuals, actually. And it's really not that bad. Just kind of almost being defiantly optimistic and defiantly rigorous in our culture was one of the major accomplishments that we've had in just the last 2 or 3 years, where we said, if you don't share these five core values, making sure that these five core values are what we talk about every single morning in our morning huddle with the employees, and every weekly teaching seminar, we go over these five core values right off the bat. And we have one-on-ones where we go through and say, are you exemplifying these five core values? To the point where I'm pretty sure at least a few people in my organization are like, if I hear these five core values one more time, I'm going to murder them. You know, but that's what it takes, right?
Yeah, the core values have been a game changer for us for sure. It's been eye-opening for us to be able to have a lens to grade your employees on, and not just on their tasks, but in their character and who they are and what they bring to the table. That's been probably our best tool.
When did it plateau? Why did it plateau? And what did you do, or what are you doing to get out of that?
So in 2020, we started renovations on our showroom to update the look. We had not done any updates since 2008. COVID happened and the store shut down. And I said, well, if nobody's going to be in here anyways, we should remodel the store. So we went ahead and tried to push the plans through our city council and get that going. But while that was happening, they let us go back in and start selling again out of our store. And so December 27th of 2020 was when we started deconstruction, just right after Christmas. And then after the build out of the new store and the grand reopening and all of that, we had our last little, our last major like jump in revenue, to where we finally hit an 8-figure showroom, which we had always dreamed about doing. That's the top 1% of jewelry stores in the country. Finally got there. We got to that at the end of 2021, and then 2022 hit, and we hit the almost to the dollar, the exact same number again. And we went, huh, we hadn't had that in a while. And then 2023, we were a little bit down from that number. And we went, huh, what's going on? You know, it's like yeah. 3 years in a row. That feels odd. And so I went to another mentor of mine by the name of Roy Williams. He's my marketing mentor. And I've known him since I was 12 years old. And you know, he was my father's marketing mentor as well. And he crunched some numbers and he said, well, congratulations, you won. And I said, what do you mean? He said, you won Midland. And I said, I don't want to win. You know, I enjoy
playing
the
game.
Winning doesn't make sense to me. And he said, what you've done so far to get to this is great. He said, this is it for that. If you want more, you've got to come up with something new. And I said, I don't want to hear that. I heard that back in 2014, and I don't want to do that again. And I thought about it for about 6 months. It took a little bit. And then I called Denise, and I said, are you ready to come on complete full time with me? And she said, yes. You know, like, just like, why hadn't you asked a year or two ago, you know?
What took you so long?
Exactly. And I said, oh yeah, I probably should have. At the same time, I just happened to have gotten a copy of Rocket Fuel and read through that, and it, you know, Visionary and Integrator, we could have just said Michael and Denise on each page instead. The Visionary page should just say Michael's page, and the Integrator page should just say Denise's page. And we kind of realized that I was doing some Integrator things and some Visionary things, and Denise was doing some Visionary things and some Integrator things. And we once again saw a path forward. And that was somewhere in 2024. You know, we said we should go all in on EOS. So we got the book, What the Heck is EOS? So, because we still didn't know, read that as well.
Yeah.
And then started looking for an implementer, and kind of set us on our new path of trying to find a route past this ceiling. And this one has been hard. We're into 2026 and maybe just now seeing a few cracks in it, really.
And Denise, when you think about that, the Visionary Integrator dynamic, oftentimes, especially when it takes a little bit of time for the visionary to let go of the vine being kind of controlling everything, how has that transition been in terms of delegation, Michael's ability to let go, and then for you to really run that operation and get it really tight?
Yeah, I think, like Michael said, when you take the exam, it was clear as day. And Michael, there were several things Michael had held on to for a long time. And finally, I asked for them. And he was like, you'd really want to do that? And I'm like, absolutely. And he was like, I was keeping this because I didn't think anyone wanted to do that or have to handle that sort of thing. And I was like, give that to me. And I think it was really the moment that Michael really realized that I really like a lot of the things that just drive him crazy. And that was really smooth sailing from that point on. Michael and I have worked together for so long. We trust each other implicitly. You know, we know as siblings when the other person feels very passionate. And, you know, sometimes you just have to trust. You just have to go, okay, hey, I see that passion. I'm going to roll with you, even though this feels really crazy. That's typically my role. But every once in a while, I bring Michael along on a ride too. For the most part, I think the letting go from the visionary really was easy for Michael because he has such big ideas. It really allowed him to get out of what was really bogging him down and give that to me. And I love that stuff. I'm not going to ever be the person with great ideas, but I can take your great idea and I can morph it and shape it and change it and come up with practical ways to get to the end, but get to the end over and over and over. I'm a systems person, a process person. And so that's really where I think I came into play, because Michael is very smart and he's got that integrator in him, so he could get to the end, but it was that process over and over and over again part, because then he was on to the next thing. And he was expecting people to continue what he started and what he told them to do. But people don't just naturally do that. They gravitate back to easy if you don't have accountability. And so that was the missing piece for us.
When you think about the state of the business today and we think about the five leadership abilities of simplify, of delegate, of predict, of systemize, and structure, how will you look at the business, or how are you looking at the business, and where do you need to simplify? Where do you need to predict a little bit better and stretch yourselves a little bit more, or find the next great delegation? And what systems and processes and what structure do you need to break through?
To start, simplify is one of the major things that I've been working on for the last 2 months. I am currently our sales floor manager right now, because we parted ways with our sales floor manager. And a lot of things that I built to be simple had become complex without me realizing it. Where, you know, somebody came along and added just one more little detail to on this side of how we ring up a sale. And, well, if you guys could just do this every time. And then all of a sudden, without realizing it, it becomes complex and hard to navigate. And, you know, within a few days of being in that management seat, I said, oh yeah, this isn't what I envisioned at all. And so it took just reworking it from the ground up, which is actually one of my favorite things to do, is go ahead and just break it back down and then build it back up until it works again. I enjoy that sort of thing.
First principles thinking. I mean, that's really, you can't scale complexity, right?
But then to convince everybody, because I'd say, you know, okay, we're taking in a jewelry repair and I just need you to do this. And they said, you know, that's only the first, you know, five steps. Exactly. And then you're done. And there was a like, pop, like, you know, cat, you know, when you catch your cat, like heading towards the cat food or what have you, where they just is like, are you sure that we only have to do steps 1 through 5? We're not going to get upset that the next steps that were originally built onto this thing after I had built steps 1 through 5, right, are like, nobody's going to get in trouble. No, nothing's going to, you know, nothing's going to come crashing down. I said, no. I said that all of these are way too complex and make the customer experience awful as they wait 15 minutes for you to finish up on a computer. And then all of a sudden this computer program that everybody hated, nobody hates it anymore real quick, you know, because right. It wasn't ever supposed to be that difficult.
Yeah. I think the biggest problem that we found with the simple system is people who love rules or boundaries. Some of us back office people, they would start adding onto the process to fix one thing. Like there was one outlier. And so you change the whole process so that if that one outlier ever happens again, your process will cover it. But that one outlier happens, you know, once every year. Well, if there's 20 of those now, you have 20 extra steps that really are unnecessary. And that's really where we've been able to, you know, get through it and really come up with the right process, the right plan, simplify it. Michael always says, okay, take your idea and take it down to the kindergarten level. And how can we do it at the most kindergarten level? And then we'll train it at that point.
And then it becomes much more scalable. You'll be able to break through. Denise, are there any other areas in the business that you see now that are ripe for simplification?
Communication. We thought we were great at communication because we talked a lot, but we're finding simplifying communication really helps a lot. And so, you know, we now meet, we talked too much. So we were constantly fixing problems throughout the day, having conversations, you know, but never really solving anything. We added a lot of Band-Aids. And now, you know, we collect it throughout the week. We collect issues. We sit down as a team. We look at them. We brainstorm them. We decide what's truly an issue and what isn't. come up with possible solutions. And if that team can't do it, then it goes up to the leadership level. So the communication, instead of being, you know, just cross-sectional, always talking back and forth, coming up with an idea and trying to pass it off, and assume that they're going to take that and run with it forever and not just use it as a band-aid for that day, now has become communication really from the ground up. We hear what the true issues are. We come up with not just a band-aid, but a solution. We get all people on board for the solution, and then we move forward. Having that simplified communication where it's like, hey, these are our headlines for the week. This is what's happening. Every team is getting the same information. We know that. Simplifying that communication has been probably, for me, the thing that has really helped us break the ceiling. Our employees are happier, and it's bringing the right problems to Michael to solve, where, you know, before the communication was, this doesn't work. We hate this system. You know, it's too cumbersome. It's too hard. Nothing ever works. And then now the communication is exactly, hey, this is not working. Well, why not? And then we can ask the five whys and really get to the issue of it and solve it once and for all. So I'd say communication has been our biggest process to simplify.
We got to make sure we stay simple. You've got some good ideas of where you can be simpler and how to hold that line. What's your next biggest, greatest delegation?
Well, we have been going through a process to find the right person to run the new store that we're opening. And that has been an interesting process because our former sales manager and, you know, a lot of people we're interviewing really have this idea that they want to be this general manager, meaning, you know, you're in charge of everything under the sun in that store. And we're really simplifying it by saying, you know, we're using our accountability chart and saying we want someone solely focused on sales and revenue. We want someone solely focused on back office. And that has been a simplification that we've really been working on, where, you know, we had put someone in a position where they had so much on their plate, they couldn't dive in and be all in on one thing. They couldn't grow one area. They were spread too thin, and they had made themselves a fireman, where you come to work and you just put out fires for everybody else and you feel good about it and you go home and you sleep and you wake up the next day to be a fireman. And we are really working to simplify that so that everybody has clear areas that they drive. We don't want firemen anymore. We want people that are driving an area forward. That way, Michael and I don't have to be the push. We don't mm-hmm. want to be the people that are constantly pushing. Michael always says when we hire people, I'd rather have to pull them back than have to push them. And so that's what we're really simplifying as we scale, is making sure that everybody has a defined role. They know what success looks like. They know what our five core values look like for their job. They're in every job description. And that is your role. And you don't have to take on too much. We want you singularly focused so you can be the best at that. And then we can all be clearly in our boundaries and we can all move forward together and row that boat faster instead of, you know, having someone spread too thin. And then they end up being firemen.
Yeah, totally. So then moving to predict, we talked a little bit about short-term predicting and solving those issues at the root. You mentioned five whys, so you don't have to ever talk about this thing again. But then thinking about long-term prediction, everything 90 days in out, you've got your new store coming in September. You're going to just have one extra store until it's profitable. But tell me a little bit about your three-year picture. Tell me about your 10-year target or your core target. What do you plan on taking this thing, and how does it impact your decision-making today?
3-year target is to get past the break-even on the second store and to break through the ceiling in store number one. We want to do both at the same time. Store number one, if we do own an unusual amount of market share, that means we have to be exceptional in every area, not just in a few key areas, in order to break that ceiling. So we're looking for every little area that we aren't flawless on and are constantly driving ourselves to be a little better every single day. And then in our second store, the idea is to, you know, be ready for anything because we've never done this before. We have no clue what we're doing when it comes to having two stores versus one store. And that, you know, from everything I've read, the problems don't double, they quadruple whenever you go from one to two. And I'm looking forward to that. That's kind of one of the main reasons that we're doing this is the challenge of it all, and that it's super fun to try and figure that out. So to get us to that past that break even point, so that then I'm allowed to start talking about the next visionary thing past that would be our 3-year goal. The 10-year is to be a dominating force in any of those markets. Moving forward, I don't want to ever go into a market where we are just another jewelry store. I find occasions to be very special, and so it needs to hold a special place in whatever community it's in. But we have to earn that. That nobody's going to give that to us. Our core focus is raising people's perception of what a jewelry store ought to be. And so that's on us. We need to raise people's perception of what they can get from a jewelry store and the experience that they can have in a jewelry store. And to be able to prove that to a new community is terrifying and exciting.
So where do you need to dig in? Where do you need to look at to get more of what you want from the business?
One of our biggest areas is our inventory management system and our back office support. Most of that will come from our flagship location, but our flagship location was at about capacity. So that was really where we looked under the hood first and said, let's get this scaled and ready before we open a new store. So we actually hired someone in. So our new store will be about 5 hours from our current location. And so we hired somebody from that area. We recently brought her in. We planned everything out. And then we decided, you know, hey, there's ways that we need to tweak. And so we've never done it before. We tried it this way. It didn't work. And so now we're trying it a separate way. And I think that's what it's going to take, is just communication. But before we can change anything, I want people to understand our why. Really, why do we currently do it this way? And then tell me what about that could be better. And what's really important to me is, it's exactly the quote that you said. I tell people all the time, if I'm the only one making decisions for this back office is only as big as I can grow it. It's only as much as I know. So I want to bring in the team. I want to hire people from outside to come and work with us. And I want their ideas to help it grow and mold and change over time, because this company is bigger than Michael and it's bigger than me. And if it's just the two of us planning everything, visualizing everything, and taking it to the next level, then that's the next ceiling we're going to hit. So we're really focused on getting our team involved, because that all water will rise together that way. So that's been a huge focus for us in the back office. I think the next phase of that, we just hired our sales manager for the new location. So we're about to do the same thing with him. He's moving to Midland for the next couple of months. He'll be training with us in Midland. And then he'll start building his team off of the way Michael is showing him how he's built our team in Midland. But he'll bring his own flair to it. And he'll no doubt, you know, help Michael see ways that we can improve in Midland also. So I think that's kind of the way we're approaching it, is this is really an opportunity for us to bring in additional people, additional minds, additional energy to help us not just grow in the new location, but break the ceiling in our flagship.
One of the ideas is just being prepared for change, you know, being knowing that a second store is going to be very different than only running one store. So not being set in any which way, but knowing where and how to change, you know, constantly reviewing the data to make sure that we know where we need to change, and then using our roles to come up with the change and then simplify it down to its easiest path forward. We're not great at predicting, I don't think, to be honest with you, but we can be very great at maneuvering.
I tell my team all the time to hold loose to what you know. Hold on to it. Be confident in what you know. But whatever we know today is not going to work in 3 years. So hold on to it. Be confident in it. But leave your hand open so that we can add more to it and things can sift out that need to sift out. You know, be confident in what you know, but we got to keep filling that up and filling the tank. And in 3 years, we should look different than we look today. Yeah, Michael and I always laugh that there's a few things that we've put in place. And I'm like, we can't be, when we turn this over to our next generation, that can't be what we hang on to. But are you still using the inventory map I created? You know, so we constantly, call each other out on that. Like, ooh, sounds like a sacred cow. Sounds like something you're emotionally tied to. And it's like, you know, you're right. We've got to let people come up with better ways and better processes. We can't just because this helped us and was like such an amazing tool. There's a new amazing tool that's going to help us coming next. But it can be hard when you created that initial tool and you're like, but it worked.
All right. So as we move to conclude here, just one last thing from you, Michael and Denise, and I'd like to hear from each of you on this. So our the listeners to the podcast, they're running businesses, probably attend a 250 person company, and they're hitting the ceiling because it is inevitable. What's the one thing that you've learned through your series of ceilings that you've broken through that you'd like to impart on that listener?
I would say one is you only know what you know, you know? So getting out of your own comfort zone, getting out of your own history and your own education is really the only path forward. What you did to get to this point, which should be celebrated because you hit a ceiling. You know how many businesses never hit a ceiling? You know, they just are there. It should be celebrated, but it's not going to be the thing that gets you past the ceiling. It can't be. Just fundamentally, by design, the ceiling exists because you got to the point that your systems and your idea took it to. So change is the only route forward.
And I think I would say be honest with yourself. There's a lot of times if you had just asked us and we were really willing to be raw and honest, we could tell you some of the reasons we hit the ceiling, and maybe it was a person that you really wanted to hold on to because they've been in the trenches with you for a long time and you really want them to come along with you on this next process, but you just know they're not the right person to do it with you. Or maybe it's something you're holding on to that you're afraid of letting control of. Hearing what people are saying, not necessarily the words that they're saying, but listen to the problems, their frustrations, and really put your finger on the pulse and figure out where the main issues are and then dive in and then be honest about it and then be willing to get really uncomfortable. Our implementer, I call her all the time. I'm like, well, I'm still swimming, but the water's above the nostrils. And she's like, she always says you have to crack a lot of eggs to make an omelet, you know? And so I texted her last month and I said, I don't know if I'm still cracking eggs or if I'm just egging my own company at this point. I don't know where we're at in this process. She's like, you're in the uncomfortable spot and that's how you know you're going to grow. And I think it's okay to be uncomfortable. It's okay to make hard choices. It is okay to hurt when you make decisions that are right for the company, but hurt, you know, you emotionally, and it's sad. You can grieve parts of the business while growing and knowing that you're making the right decision.
Love it. All right, Michael, Denise, enjoyed the conversation and thanks again.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark.
If this conversation gave you something to think about, I'd love to keep that going. I write a newsletter called Clarity Break Thoughts, where I share simple ideas, questions, and reminders to help you step back, think clearly, and lead with more intention. You can subscribe at eosworldwide.com/claritybreakthoughts. Again, that's eosworldwide.com/claritybreakthoughts.